Hello, and welcome to Bardcast, the Shakespeare podcast. I'm Carson.
And I'm Jeff.
And today's episode is about King Henry IV, Part 1, also known as the first part of King Henry IV. We have some vocabulary for this episode. Our first word is sack. Well, you probably know that as a tackle in football.
Or a bag that you hold things in.
To Shakespeare and his folk, sack is also a type of Spanish sweet wine, which we will find a lot of in this play.
It's just, in his play, they generically refer to all alcohol, but pretty much wine, as sack.
Exactly.
So if we say sack, it's wine.
Mm-hmm. Another vocabulary word for today is an arras, A-R-R-A-S. Today known as something that Polonius dies behind.
A curtain.
Yeah.
It's a curtain.
It's a curtain or a tapestry near a wall that
you can hide behind.
In Shakespeare plays, characters hide behind. And famously, Hamlet's Polonius died behind one.
Mm-hmm.
Something that we forgot to mention in Shakespeare's England is the country slash region of England known as Wales.
First off, it is a separate country, but it is part of the United Kingdom.
Yes.
And it's been frequently conquered and stuff like that.
So the region called Wales comes up in this play because Wales and Scotland form an alliance to go to war against England.
Sort of.
If you look at a map of England, it's sort of a vertical line up and down, and there is a projection on the left or west side of the island. This projection is Wales. While everyone is familiar with the term poetry and poems, the alternative to poetry is known as prose. It's a less well-known term. Essentially, prose means you are not talking in poetry, so the way that we're talking right now is in prose.
Except, isn't prose generally scripted?
No, just anything that isn't poetry is technically prose.
Interesting.
Shakespeare uses an unusually large amount of prose in this play, particularly for the character of Falstaff, who never speaks in any sort of meter.
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if that's deliberate or not, though.
It's impossible to know today.
If it is, it could say some more about his character, though.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's sort of uncultured, so that goes in with his general character. So, where did Shakespeare get this story?
Well, first off, there was a real English person named King Henry IV.
Right, and he did have a first part.
Mm-hmm.
And Shakespeare read about King Henry IV in a book known as Holinshed's Histories.
Mm-hmm.
We've referred to this before because this is the book that Shakespeare uses most.
Especially for the Henriad.
Yeah, all of his histories are essentially based on Holinshed's histories.
Slight exaggeration there, but I'll let you have it.
Naturally, it is in the genre of history.
Mm-hmm.
And the character of Falstaff, who we will get to later, is inspired by the character John Oldcastle in another play at the same time.
Well, John Oldcastle was also a real person.
Right, but the character of Falstaff is inspired by the play The Famous Victories of Henry V, in which the character John Oldcastle is a prominent figure. This is actually one of the more popular produced plays of Shakespeare's time. It had a great deal of printings. We know it was at least in production by 1597, because suddenly we find a lot of references to the character of Falstaff, who appears first in this play. In the popular culture, people start making references to him. And we know it was printed in 1598, 1599, 1604, 1608, 1613, 1622, 1632, and 1639.
Yep.
So, nearly 10 printings, which is...
You mean 8 printings. There were 8 printings. You can just say 8 printings.
So, 8 printings, sure, which is more than any other play of Shakespeare's had during his day.
And there is no real difference between the different printings. They all... So, any one of them is almost exactly the same as any other one of them.
Right, we don't see the same sort of problems we have with Hamlet and Lear, where the different printings have different meanings and different speeches attached to them.
So we can be pretty certain that this play came down pretty much exactly as Shakespeare intended it.
Right. So when it comes to the setting, obviously, we're looking at England, the England Yep. of King Henry IV. Mm-hmm. But this isn't the real England of King Henry IV. This is Shakespeare's England, where things happen according to dramatic necessity.
And characters change ages and aliveness at certain times.
Everything is according to convenience, not according to history. Shakespeare knew better than for a lot of these details, but that's not the point of the play.
Right. The point is to tell a good story.
Yeah.
Never let the truth get in the way of a good story.
Precisely. I think that could be Shakespeare's mottos for the histories. When you look at the play, you can divide it into three groups of characters.
Not including the ones who don't count.
Right.
The first group, the boring group, is the group following King Henry IV, who you may remember as Henry Bolingbroke from Richard II.
Right. This play starts off 2 years after Richard II.
Only two?
Yes.
Wow.
King Henry IV has several characters that only really appear around him, so we kind of group them together.
Mm-hmm.
And that includes his son, Prince John.
Yep. Lord John of Lancaster also.
Yeah. Westmoreland.
Mm-hmm.
Who is one of the nobles that works for him. Walter Blunt, who basically works as a messenger throughout this play.
He's known as a noble knight, basically. It's the Earl of Northumberland. He's one of King Henry's advisors slash people he talks to.
Right. The people that are around King Henry IV aren't that important because Henry IV isn't the focus of the play.
The focus of the play concentrates on two other groups of characters.
And the main character of the entire play...
And the next two plays.
He's Prince Hal. He is the star of this play. He is the star of King Henry IV Part 2. And he is naturally, when he becomes Henry V, he is the star of Henry V.
He is referred to as Hal, Harry, or very rarely Prince Henry.
Right. And technically...
Or the Prince of Wales.
Technically, he is Harry Monmouth.
Yeah.
If you wanted to refer to him as a unique figure.
Yeah. And he's basically... The first part of the play deals with the fact that he's slumming a lot.
Yeah.
The group of characters around Hal are...
The main character of his coterie is Falstaff.
Specifically, Sir John Falstaff.
Who we know is a knight, since he is a sir, and who is a poor, old, fat...
Drunk.
Crude.
Cowardly.
Criminal. Who mainly seems to get along by being clever enough to impress Hal and keep him entertained.
Mm-hmm.
Depending on your interpretation. This character has so much interpretation and so much written about him that we are going to make an entire episode about him later, so we're not going to dwell on him for the purposes of this podcast. Also hanging out with Hal is the character Points.
He's probably the character other than Hal and Falstaff in this group with the most screen time.
He's one of Hal's friends.
Yeah.
They associate together and they work together.
Yeah, they seem to pal around more than the other ones.
Right. And there are some other characters who aren't significant as characters, but
the rest are fairly interchangeable.
Yeah, they're significant for the plot.
There's Gadshill,
who is a thief who is employed by Henry to execute a robbery.
Mm-hmm. And Bardolph.
And Pato, also who are engaged in this robbery. Francis, servant that Hal and Points goof off with to embarrass him, essentially. They just play a prank on him. He's not a significant character.
And then there's Mistress Quickly, who owns the tavern they hang out in.
She's also known as the hostess.
Yes.
She is kind of the authority figure at the inn where they tend to frequent.
Yeah. And then there's the awesome group, slash the rebels.
Yeah, this is the third group of the three groups that we referred to earlier.
The leader of this group is Hotspur,
also known as
Henry Percy, or Henry Percy.
Or Henry Hotspur, or Henry Percy II.
To differentiate between the three main Henrys in this play, King is Henry, the Prince is Hal, and Hotspur is Hotspur.
Right. There are at least four Henrys in this play because Hotspur's father is also named Henry, but we don't refer to him as that.
He's referred to as Percy.
Yeah, we have a specific reference for all the different characters so we don't get confused.
Yep, so there's Hotspur, his wife, Kate, his father, Percy, and then Worcester.
This is spelled Worcester, so if you see Worcester, it's pronounced Worcester.
And he's another earl, I believe. Then there's Glendower, who is...
He's the leader of the Welsh part of the rebellion.
The Welsh contingent, yes.
Yeah, and he believes he's magic, essentially.
He claims to be able to talk to spirits and such.
Yeah, he has some good lines where Hotspur makes fun of him.
Yeah, there's Mortimer, the Earl of March.
Who's just another noble in the rebellion.
Yep. And there's Douglas, who is the...
Leader of the Scots.
Yes.
And his name is Archibald. Technically, Douglas is a title that the leader of the Scots holds, but we generally refer to him as Douglas.
Well, he's the Earl of Douglas.
Yeah.
There's Sir Vernon, who doesn't matter.
Yeah. And the Archbishop of York, who is also known as Sir Scroop, because he has a silly name.
Mm-hmm.
He is one of the co-conspirators, but he does not participate in the actual battling or anything like that, since he's a bishop.
And then there's an ostler, two carriers, a chamberlain... Oh, no, there's also a sheriff. Travelers, a servant, Mortimer's wife, who is also Welsh, and
she has no written dialogue, but she several times refers to it as just speaking in Welsh.
And then she sings a song, too.
Yeah.
And then Sir Michael.
So, I've thought of a feature that we haven't done before, and I thought we'd test it out for this episode.
If it
where,
goes well.
Either, if you would like to do it too, we can, but one of us tries to summarize the entire play as quickly as possible. I call it the 60-second summary.
Okay, do you want to do it or should I? Or should we? Do you want to do it?
Well, we can both try to do it if you'd like.
Okay, at the same time?
No. Okay. But would you like to try it?
Sure. Okay, so.
So I'm going to try to essay a 60-second summary of this play. So it begins with Henry IV being eager to go to the Holy Land to invade there as part of the Crusades when he discovers that the Civil War has again broken out in the country. And while this goes on, Prince Henry and Falstaff goof off. Then King Henry decides that he will antagonize Hotspur, who decides to join the Scots and Welsh in the rebellion. Hal and Falstaff go on a robbery where Hal robs Falstaff in his own turn, thereby embarrassing him. And later, Falstaff tries to create a story of how he was robbed by an army, but Henry embarrasses him by telling him what actually happened. King Henry goes to Prince Henry and says, "You've really been embarrassing me with how terribly you've been acting lately," and the prince vows that he will win back his honor by killing Hotspur on the field of battle. The armies of the England and Welsh and Scotland go to war, where Henry, the prince, actually does defeat Hotspur in one-on-one combat, killing him. In the end, Hal does win his honor, and King Henry leads the army to finish the rebel army.
Okay, that took more than 60 seconds, but let me try, okay?
Okay.
So, Henry is upset that his son Henry is gadding about with some guy named Falstaff. So, he gets in an argument with Henry, who decides to rebel against Henry, and because his son is a worthless Henry. So, Henry and his father Henry begin rebelling along with some Scots and some Welshmen. Meanwhile, Henry gets his son Henry to reform, and they declare war on Henry and Henry. And so Henry, yes, that's right, meet on the field of battle. Henry kills Henry. Henry defends Henry. And Falstaff claims to have killed Henry, and Henry wins the day.
Don't forget that the other Henry gets away and survives.
Yes, well, he doesn't matter very much.
It's implied that he is going to be executed later.
Yes.
And now we will do a more formal summary of the play.
This is going to be a long one, guys.
Well, we're going to try to go through it rapidly.
Act 1.
Scene 1. So, Henry IV, like we said earlier...
We're in his palace right now.
So, we've started from 2 years after Richard II. In Richard II, Henry vows that he's going to invade the Holy Land as part
to make up for his, having something to do with the murder of the previous king.
Yeah, he feels that he's guilty, so he wants to lead part of the Crusades to wipe blood from his hands, presumably with more blood. At the beginning of the play, he has a speech where he reveals that he hasn't had a chance to do that because England has been racked by civil war, essentially since he got there. He plans now to go and invade the Holy Land, but someone comes in and announces that the Welsh and the Scots have decided to renew the battles that they've been having recently.
Mm-hmm.
And so he doesn't have the chance to go off, and he needs to summon up a new army.
Yeah.
At this point, he gets into an argument with someone over Henry Hotspur, who at this time does work for Henry IV, because Henry IV wants all the hostages that Henry Hotspur has won in battle.
Yeah, this is a kind of an unusual point here that Shakespeare mostly made up.
Right. It is true that Henry Hotspur only gave King Henry IV one of the hostages that he won, but that's because that's what you're supposed to do. At the time, the king had the rights to all noble hostages, so Hotspur gave him that one and didn't give him the other one. In real life, the king didn't mind this, and Hotspur becomes a revolutionary for a different reason. Mm-hmm. In the play, this is what prompts the entire participation of Hotspur in the Civil War.
This also introduces the Earl of Douglas as the leader of the Scots, and Glendower as the leader of the Welsh.
Right. So, we're moving on to scene 2.
Yep.
This is the introduction of the immortal Sir John Falstaff. Falstaff is lying down on a bench, asleep in the middle of the day. Prince Henry meets him and immediately starts mocking him and calling him a terrible person.
Basically just, making fun of the fact that he's fat, stupid, drunk, asleep on a bench afternoon. I believe we were watching the movie of this, and you commented that they seemed very obsessed with time.
There are several references to time in this play, and it begins with the beginning of scene 2, where Falstaff asks Henry, "What time of day is it?" And Prince Henry points out that there's no use for the time of day for Falstaff, because all he cares about is getting drunk, eating, and wenching. So unless the time were alcohol, women, and food, he wouldn't have any use for the time of day.
Mm. Now, keep in mind, the time of day is important in the sense that they are telling the audience what time of day it is in the play.
Right. Shakespeare is very good at revealing details by having characters inquire about them. Mm-hmm. Other shows are less elegant with that. In a lot of shows, they've got a character who doesn't know what's going on, so they can ask, hey guys, what's going on? Then they can explain to this character, and thereby explain to the audience.
So then,
Falstaff and Henry have amazing repartee here. It's really celebrated as some of Shakespeare's best writing, the back and forth of Falstaff dodging Henry's insults and insulting him in turn.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the puns don't really hold by today, but it's still quite good. A few of them still work today without any sort of translation. It's interesting, they have several references to the Bible, the Book of Psalms, and it just seems, at the time, I guess it was just assumed that any random person would just know the Bible pretty well.
Which is a fair case.
Right. Today, any sort of biblical allusion to a not famous portion of the Bible would probably go over most people's heads.
Mm. And then they talk a little bit about Falstaff wants to commit a robbery.
Yeah, and this scene also gives the phrase, give the devil his due.
And then there's a really enjoyable line. The prince says, I see a good amendment of life in thee, from praying to purse-taking. Why, Hal, 'tis my vocation. 'Tis no sin for a man to labor in his vocation.
So saying, I am a thief, therefore it is not wrong for me to steal.
Or like, it's my job to be a thief, so, and I'm good at it, so I should do it. Poins comes in at this point.
He reveals that he has a secret plan, eventually. He convinces Henry to go along with the robbery. Then he reveals to Henry, we're not actually going to rob anyone except Falstaff. See, Falstaff and his group are going to rob the travelers. Then we will rob them, and we'll get a joke out of how silly the lies of Falstaff will be.
Mm-hmm. Specifically, the travelers are pilgrims going to Canterbury.
Like the Canterbury Tales.
Exactly.
And this is the scene where Prince Henry reveals why he is doing all of these ill-mannered things. He says that he will be like the sun who goes behind clouds so that when he emerges from the clouds, people remark that much more. Essentially saying that he will act bad now so that when he becomes good later, people will think it is remarkable instead of thinking that it's just business as usual.
Yeah, It's one of the more controversial speeches in this play, according to Shakespeare scholars.
A lot of people think that he isn't serious.
A lot of people are wrong.
This is exactly what he does in the coming times. He does exactly this. He acts like a bad person until he becomes king, and then he immediately reforms himself.
Well, it's more like he acts like a bad person until acting like a good person would have the best benefit for him.
Right.
But this speech really changes the dynamic of the play. It shows Henry is much more calculating and cool than someone who's just reforming because it's the right thing to do would be.
If you ignore this play, Prince Henry is the happy guy just palling around with Falstaff. If you really take this part seriously, then Falstaff is just clinging by a thread to Henry's approval, because Henry at any time could just turn around and say, I don't need you anymore.
And then we're back to the palace.
King Henry decides that this holding of hostages that Hotspur has refused to give to the king is unacceptable, and he will see him punished or he will get those hostages by any means necessary. And Hotspur tells a good story about how he was on the field of battle having won the battle, and this noble came to him in fancy clothing with perfume saying, oh, this war offends me, I find it beneath me. And Hotspur was so enraged by this fancy pants noble's behavior that he just refused to give him anything because of how outrageously proud this noble who had done nothing was.
Hotspur is a pretty awesome character. He basically, you could imagine every line he says in this play is him just practically shouting.
The performance of Hotspur can really sell this character. He's a dynamic, forceful, happy character.
Mm.
And you can really get some good performances out of the material that Shakespeare gives you.
Mm.
King Henry in this scene has a speech that kind of imitates Julius Caesar. He says to Worcester, get thee gone, for I do see danger and disobedience in thine eye. Your presence is too bold and peremptory, and majesty might never yet endure the moody frontier of a servant's brow. Which reminds me of that Cassius has a lean and hungry look. Get men like that from me, from Julius Caesar.
It comes to issue here that one of the main issues is some guy named Mortimer, too.
turns out that the Scots have taken Mortimer hostage, and Hotspur would like to exchange the hostages that he's taken for Mortimer, since he is Hotspur's friend.
Yes. It's the Welsh who have taken Mortimer. Because they talk about Glendower and how crazy he is.
Henry accuses Mortimer of being a traitor. Hotspur is enraged by this.
Mm-hmm.
He says that Mortimer was the most heroic of the battle, that he fought for hours on the river, and
yep.
that the army is basically fled before him. King Henry refuses to listen to this, and they all leave.
Mm-hmm. And Hotspur just blows up at his...
It's a good thing the king left, because Hotspur just insults the king personally and says that instead of never mentioning Mortimer again, he'll go to the king in his sleep and yell Mortimer in his ear, and that he'll train a bird to say nothing but Mortimer and give him to the king.
Yeah. And so now Hotspur, Northumberland, and Worcester chat for a while. Northumberland is Hotspur's father.
Yeah, and they have a plan. Instead of giving Henry the hostages, they will give them to the Scottish and the Welsh and join their forces. They'll give them the hostages as a show of good faith, and then...
make an alliance against Henry.
Exactly. They figure that there's no way they can win his approval at that point, so the only thing to do is join the other side. This section also has the word pismires, which is, in modern terms, ants. And the word pismire comes from the fact that apparently ants smelled like a mire of piss, and I am not making that up. This scene also has the phrase, the game is afoot.
Mm-hmm. Is this the first use of that phrase?
I think that Shakespeare was the one who made it known. It might not be the first one ever, but this is the famous one.
Mm-hmm. And so they leave, and we're on to Act 2, Scene 1.
This one isn't a very important one. You've got a bunch of characters who aren't important talking about their work as both...
ostlers, carriers.
And Gadshill is a thief.
Yep.
So it turns out that Gadshill and the person who is the chamberlain for this inn are coordinating to rob people.
Yeah, basically the chamberlain will tell him, these are rich people.
Yeah, essentially this scene sets up who they're going to rob and that it's going to happen soon.
And then, amusingly enough, they go to the road by Gadshill, a place.
Well, this is why he has the name Gadshill, because he is named after the place where he operated. He is a real historical character.
Is he?
Yeah.
I did not know that.
Mm-hmm. Gadshill makes fun of the nobility, saying, they pray continually to their saint, the Commonwealth, or rather, not pray to her, but pray on her, for they ride up and down on her and make her their boots. That's two different uses of pray. Oh, this section also mentions that their chamber breeds fleas like a loach, which is a type of fish. For some reason, people at the time thought that this particular kind of fish was infested with fleas, which makes no sense, because...
they're fish.
Yeah, fleas don't live underwater, but their science wasn't very good at the time.
Yep. Anyways.
Scene 2.
Prince Henry and Poins are there, and talking about how... and Poins mentions that he just stole Falstaff's horse.
Mm-hmm. And Falstaff soon arrives, starts yelling at them for taking the horse, and there's a good line where Prince Henry asks Falstaff to lie down and listen to the ground to see if he can hear the travelers coming, and Falstaff asks, have you a lever to get me back up after I lie down? See, he's very fat and old.
I also like the line where he shouts, I am a curse to rob in that thieves' company.
At this point, the plan that Henry had earlier is executed without any sort of slip-up. Both John Falstaff successfully robs the travelers, and Prince Henry successfully robs John Falstaff.
And basically, Falstaff and his pals just flee immediately from Henry and from Hal and Poins.
Right, specifically, Falstaff, after a blow or two, runs away. So,
leaving the booty behind.
At best, he barely defended himself before they flee. And the other two didn't even bother. And Poins says, how the rogue roared.
And we're on to scene 3. Warkworth, a room in the castle. Hotspur, reading a letter out loud.
He reads this letter that basically says, don't go through with this rebellion. Your friends aren't very good. This is incredibly dangerous. And he has a counter for everything of it, saying, when he's told that it's dangerous, he says, why, that's certain. 'Tis dangerous to take a cold, to sleep, to drink. But I tell you, my lord fool, out of this nettle danger we pluck this flower safety. Yeah, so he's eloquent and bold and confident in his purposes.
And then after talking about how awesome he is, his wife, Kate, enters.
Yeah, and it turns out that she's basically been completely in the dark with all of his activities and all his plans.
Mm-hmm.
The only reason she knows what's going on is because he's been dreaming, and in his dreams he'll talk about war and sallies and trenches and tents and shout, "Courage to the field!" and stuff like that. So he's obviously dreaming of war. We really learn a lot about Hotspur's character in this play, considering that he's like the third level of character, theoretically.
Yeah. And he and his wife have a really good relationship, it looks like, too. Like, they constantly insult and belittle each other, but at the same time, they, like, bring, like, all sorts of romance into it, too.
A lot of this depends on the way that this is played.
Mm-hmm.
You can play this as very, very bad relationship. If they're perfectly serious throughout this scene, they are cruel people. Hotspur says that he does not love her and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
But if you play it as lightly joking, which I think is a better way to interpret it,
mm-hmm.
then it does seem like a very positive relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Lady Percy asks Hotspur, "What is it carries you away?" And Hotspur says, "Why, my horse."
And then in the version we saw, she hits him.
Yeah, so they goof off quite a bit.
Yep.
Hotspur says that he doesn't have time for women's business. This is no world to play with mammoths and to tilt with lips. We must have bloody noses and cracked crowns and pass them current, too. So he's a man's man mm-hmm. in a man's world.
Yeah, pretty awesome. He's just he's my favorite character in this play by far.
Yeah, we love Hotspur.
Mm-hmm. Back to Hal.
Yeah, scene four. Hal and Points are kind of glorying in their victory.
Talking about how well things went.
And here they have a goofy little scene with Francis that we mentioned in the cast list. This has been cut in every performance I've seen of this play, because it's completely unnecessary. Basically, this servant Francis always says, "Anon," when someone yells at him to do something, saying, basically, "I'll be there in a moment." So when someone yells, "Francis," he says, "Anon, anon." Henry asks him questions, and Points is in another room shouting for Francis. And so all of Francis's responses are simply, "Anon." So Henry says, I have £1,000 for you. When would you like it?" And then Francis responds, "Anon." And Henry says, "I thought you would like to have the money." So it's just goofing around.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of pointless to the max.
I'm not surprised that this is cut by every performance I've seen. Although I can imagine it could be entertaining.
It could be. It's just pointless, and it's already a long play.
Yeah, you can tell that Prince Henry is impressed by Hotspur when he says, I am not yet of Percy's mind, this Hotspur of the North. He that kills some 6 or 7 dozen of Scots at the breakfast, washes his hands and says to his wife, "Fie upon this quiet life, I want work."
It's pretty awesome.
Yeah.
It's like Hotspur is the Chuck Norris of this time.
And in scenes, Hotspur refers to Prince Henry with nothing but disdain because Henry's living this life of ribaldry and bawdiness.
And not killing any Scotsmen at all.
So Falstaff comes in, shouting, "A plague upon all cowards!"
Mm-hmm.
And, because he's going to accuse Henry and Points of being cowards because they didn't help them.
In the robbery, exactly.
Yeah, that they just did nothing. So he's shouting about how he hates cowards and how there's only 3 good men unhanged in England, and one of them is fat and grows old, referring to himself.
Mm-hmm.
So he's saying that the world is going to hell, and he's one of the only good people left. Of course, we'll see that's not the case.
They go on to, Falstaff claims that they took the money. The 4 of them fought off 100 men to steal the money.
They immediately start questioning his story. He has actually poked holes in his clothing and chopped up his sword, so it looks like they've been in an epic battle.
So, here, let's just read this part out.
Pray God you have not murdered some of them.
Nay, that's past praying for. I have peppered 2 of them. 2 I am sure I have paid. 2 rogues in buckram suits. I tell thee what, Hal, if I tell thee a lie, spit in my face. Call me horse. Thou knowest my old ward. Here I lay, and thus I bore my point. 4 rogues in buckram leapt drive at me.
What 4? Thou saidst but 2 even now.
4, Hal. I told thee 4.
Aye, he said 4.
These 4 came all affront and mainly thrust at me. I made me no more ado, but took all their 7 points in my target thus.
7? Why, there were just 4 even now.
In buckram?
Aye, 4 in buckram suits.
7 by these hilts, or I am a villain else.
Prithee, let him alone. He shall have more anon.
Dost thou hear me, Hal?
Aye, and mark thee too, Jack.
Do so, for it is worth listening to. These 9 in buckram that I told thee of.
So, 2 more already.
Their points being broken.
Down fell their hose.
That's a pun that doesn't make any sense anymore.
Yup.
Began to give me ground, but I followed me close, came in foot in hand, and with a thought, 7 of the 11 I paid.
Oh, monstrous! 11 buckram men grown out of 2.
But as the devil would have it, three misbegotten knaves in Kendall Green came at me at my back and let drive at me. For it was so dark, Hal, that thou couldst not see thy hand.
These lies are like their father that begets them, gross as a mountain, open, palpable. Why, thou clay-brained guts, thou not-pated fool, thou whoreson, obscene, greasy tallow-keech. Eventually, after making absolutely sure that Falstaff is a fool, Prince Henry does reveal that they were the ones who robbed them in turn.
And so he's like, yeah, we got you, Falstaff. And we just caught you out in an epic lie.
And they're leaning over him saying, how could you possibly get out of this one?
And Falstaff said, I knew it was you all along. But you know me, if I murdered the prince, there'd be no end of trouble.
Yeah, so he says, I could have killed all of you. I just knew it was you. That's it. Mm-hmm. I ran away. He says that he is a coward by instinct.
Yes.
So I hope that this gives you some of the idea of why people love Falstaff.
Mm-hmm. So they have confronted him and beaten him down. He's fought his way back.
Yeah, so the hostess is there to reveal that the king wants to talk to Prince Henry.
Yes, because there's all this trouble brewing.
So they come upon an idea. Prince Henry says to Falstaff, you stand for my father, and we will have a conversation, essentially practicing what the conversation will be in real life.
Yes.
And Falstaff, the way he talks is a parody of the speech at the time. There was a popular style of speech known as euphonia, where you say contradicting terms, kind of go back and forth. It's just a very pretentious way of talking.
Mm-hmm. So this is a long thing, so I don't think we want to read it all out loud.
No, but I wish we could because it is very humorous. Essentially, when Falstaff is pretending to be the king, he says, have you heard of this man, Falstaff? He is truly great. I hope that you do love him in all things and that you help him in all ways.
He's basically saying, you're hanging out with a bunch of rogues except for this one great, glorious man.
I see virtue in his looks, he says.
Yep. And then Hal is just like, no, no, okay, let me play the king and you play me.
Pure silliness at this point. But when Prince Henry proposes it, John Falstaff, still pretending to be the king, says, depose me.
Yes. And so the prince gets up and basically curses himself out for hanging out with a bunch of drunks, including the villainous, abominable misleader of youth, Falstaff, that old white-bearded Satan.
Wherein villainous, but in all things. Wherein worthy, but in nothing. Just saying that he is basically pure bad.
And then Falstaff...
Falstaff says, I don't know who you're talking about.
Yeah. And he says, no, my good lord, banish Peto, banish Bardolph, banish Poins, but for sweet Jack Falstaff, kind Jack Falstaff, true Jack Falstaff, valiant Jack Falstaff, and therefore more valiant, being as he is old Jack Falstaff, banish not him from thy Harry's company, banish not him thy Harry's company, banish plump Jack, and banish all the world.
And Prince Henry, apparently in all seriousness, says, I do, I will. This, you know, this ties in with the entire idea of him acting bad for a while, and then becoming good later. He has every intention of dumping all these people.
Yes. And then, before Falstaff can react to this, a knocking is heard.
Yeah, Falstaff wants to, he says, I have much to say on behalf of that Falstaff, but it's not the time, because the sheriff is here.
Yes, and so then they discuss, Falstaff basically convinces Hal to not tell the sheriff that he's hiding behind the heiress.
Right.
Which is why we brought up that vocab earlier.
The sheriff is there to arrest him for the robbery.
Yes.
And everyone knows that it's Falstaff, because Falstaff has such a unique figure.
In the sense that he's really fat.
Exactly. And so the sheriff arrives with Falstaff behind the heiress, and Henry says, the man, I do assure you, is not here, which is him kind of being tricky, because, of course, although he is not there, he is right over in the next part of the room. And he says, he is not here, for I myself at this time have employed him, meaning I have told him to hide behind that curtain.
Yes, but he says, once I find him, I'll send him to you by tomorrow, dinner time.
Right. And even though this conversation is less than 50 lines, by the time the sheriff leaves, they go back to the heiress and discover that Falstaff has already fallen asleep.
Yes. Well, the prince is outside, possibly selling him out.
Yeah, something incredibly important to Falstaff is going on, but he manages to fall asleep almost instantly.
And then they pick his pockets.
Yeah, specifically, he searcheth his pockets and findeth certain papers.
Yep.
And the one that they actually read is a receipt, which essentially shows that Falstaff has bought about 10 shillings worth of alcohol and party favors, and half of a penny worth of bread.
Specifically 2 gallons of sack.
An epic amount of alcohol and hardly any bread is all that Falstaff needs.
Yeah, and so we go on to Act 3.
Scene 1.
And we're back to Hotspur.
Where they've kind of decided that they're in a good way. They think that they can win this war because they've got enough people that have signed on.
So they've got Hotspur, Worcester, Mortimer, and Glendower.
Yeah, this is where Glendower reveals that he thinks that he's magic. He says that when he's born that there were comets in the sky and that there was an earthquake. Hotspur points out that even if he hadn't been born, if it was just the birth of a kitten, those same things would have happened. They just happened as a coincidence.
And Glendower says, I can call spirits from the vasty deep.
And Hotspur responds, anyone can call spirits. Will they do what you say? Glendower says, I can teach you, cousin, to command the devil. And Hotspur says, I can teach thee to shame the devil by telling truth. Tell truth and shame the devil.
And then Mortimer's like, calm down, guys, calm down. We've got a common enemy. We don't have to beat up on each other.
Glendower tries to prove that he's magic again and again, and Hotspur gives him nothing but the business. They have a little conversation about how they want to divide England, which seems kind of irrelevant because they, you know, don't win.
But if they this is how they would divide it if they would win.
Right. It's not really very important. There's a conversation about rerouting a river. There's no historical record for them wanting to do this. This is probably a reference to pop culture of Shakespeare's time, where there was talk about rerouting a river.
Yeah, it's kind of okay.
Yeah, it's not bad. It's just getting the plot going.
Mm-hmm. And then
Mortimer kind of has a problem because his wife speaks no English, and he speaks no Welsh.
Mm-hmm. And they need Glendower to translate between them.
Yeah, that seems very awkward.
Yeah. Especially considering that Mortimer was Glendower's hostage for a little while.
But the lady knows that Mortimer is going to battle, and so Mortimer says that he understands thy looks, that pretty Welsh which thou pourest down from those swelling heavens, that is her eyes. Mm-hmm. He understands that too perfectly, and but for shame, he would cry as well.
Hotspur's wife, Kate, has shown up at this point, too.
So there is some conversation in Welsh. This would be an interesting thing to put on in a play, because there's no specific dialogue for the lady to speak in Welsh.
And then Mortimer gets her to sing in Welsh, and there's a song in Welsh.
Yeah, this is sort of their last night before their very probable deaths. Mm-hmm. So they spend it with their friends and with their wives.
Oh, and then Hotspur tries to get Kate to sing, and she refuses.
So, scene two.
Back to London with the king.
This is the dressing down. Prince Henry has been summoned by King Henry, and King Henry essentially says, you have been an awful person. What is your deal?
Well, throughout the play, he's been commenting this, but he again comments, I wish Hotspur were my kid.
Yeah, he's been saying several times now, oh, if only I had been the father of the other Henry. Hotspur is such a noble and valiant person. He even says now that Hotspur is leading a rebellion, that Hotspur has a better claim to the throne than Hal, because Hotspur actually cares for the people and he wants to rule England, and all Henry has is that he's the son of a usurper. That's the only claim he has to the throne.
Yeah, it also shows a little bit more about the king's insecurities in his own position.
Right, he compares the situation that is going on right now to Richard II's situation. He compares Hal to Richard II and Hotspur to himself, the King Henry IV, saying that Hotspur, in all rightness, would get the throne instead of you, just as I got the throne instead of Richard II. But Henry assures him that all these things that I am doing, I will amend, and I will win back my honor. Henry IV reveals his secret plan of being popular, essentially hiding himself away and only revealing himself in very important situations. Therefore, his appearance being rare, it is valuable, and people thought he was cool for that, where Richard II lived a life of badness in the same way that Prince Hal is doing. Henry vows that he will win his honor through killing Hotspur. He says that in the field of battle he will wear a garment all of blood and stain his favors in a bloody mask, which, washed away, shall scour my shame with it. He says that Percy is but his factor, that is to say, employee, good my lord, to buy up glorious deeds on my behalf.
Like, if you were looking at it from a different angle, he would be the villain of the play.
If you look at him as a very cold and calculating person, he can be a bad person entirely in this play.
I mean, if things had turned out different in English history, Hotspur would be a much better hero for this.
Oh, yeah. If the rebels won, Hotspur would be the hero of all England.
So, anyways, back to the tavern.
Yeah, scene three.
Falstaff and Bardolph.
Oh, Falstaff has a good speech about how he is virtuous enough. How he is like, a good person because he swears little. He dices not more than 7 times a week, that is, every day. He goes not to a brothel more than once in a quarter of an hour. And he paid money that he borrowed 3 or 4 times, and that he lived well and in good compass. And now he lives all out of order, out of all compass. And Bardolph points out he's so fat he could fit into no compass. It's simply not possible. And Falstaff makes fun of Bardolph in turn.
And he asks the hostess if she knows who picked his pocket.
Right, he's essentially accusing the hostess of robbing him.
Yes.
Although all that he lost were the stupid receipts that Henry was reading earlier.
Mm-hmm. But he's pretending he lost more than that.
Right, that he lost a great deal of money. Prince Henry returns, and they both reveal their charges to Henry. The hostess points out that Falstaff has been talking about the prince behind his back, saying that he owes him £1,000 and that he would beat Prince Henry if he lied to him and stuff like that. Prince Henry says, "Do I owe you £1,000? And Falstaff says, £1,000, Hal? 1,000,000. Thy love is worth 1,000,000. Thou owest me thy love." He has a constant witticism that protects him from all his shenanigans.
And, I mean, he's really not a great person.
No, he's a bad person, but he's very clever.
Yeah.
Which is how he keeps himself going. He's always dancing, metaphorically. So it turns out that Henry just gives him back his stuff that he had stolen earlier. Falstaff, at one point, just offhandedly says, "God be thanked for these rebels. They offend none but the virtuous."
Yeah.
Henry and Falstaff have repaired their situation, so Henry tells Falstaff that he will give Falstaff the command of a bunch of soldiers.
Yeah. In a way, it's to allow Falstaff to prove himself.
Yeah, both to prove himself and to help in the war effort.
Yeah.
We'll find out that he's not very honorable
good
in this regard.
Well, honor and Falstaff don't exactly go together.
No, rarely.
And then we're on to Act 4.
Yep, Scene 1.
The rebel camp.
This is bad times for the rebels.
Yep, they've just found out that a lot of their backers have backed out.
Their allies are either sick or unable to come in time for the battle.
Hotspur's own father is ill.
Yeah, so Hotspur is completely undissuaded, though. He is still confident. He actually says that with fewer people, they will simply look more courageous, because if they have a smaller army, it is more brave to go to war against a larger army. He is completely incapable of being talked down from this war.
He believes they are right, and God is on their side. And he is just so awesome that he can't lose anyway.
Their valor will bring them victory.
Mm-hmm.
Sir Richard Vernon, who basically is not an important character, does have a great speech about the madcap Prince of Wales and his comrades.
Oh, yeah.
Saying how great they looked as they got ready for war, saying that they were plumed like ostriches that push against the wind, baited like eagles having lately bathed, glittering in golden coats, as gorgeous as the sun in midsummer. He goes on and on, but it's a very poetic thing about a young man going to war.
Mm-hmm. And Hotspur says it's all just, you know, showing off that he knows all about this Harry, and he wishes that he were a better fighter because it would make his victory all the more glorious.
So then we go back to scene two with Falstaff, where Falstaff has not been doing very good work. The thing with army at this time is that Falstaff is essentially assigned to draft 150 people.
Mm-hmm.
So he went to a bunch of rich people and said, "I will draft you unless you give me some money." He went to 150 rich people and said, "Give me some money," essentially. He basically robbed a bunch of people.
Yeah.
And they said, "Okay, I'll give you some money." So he's made a lot of money from that. And then he went to the poorest and worst people he could find and drafted them. So he has this army that looks like the most pathetic people you've ever seen. He comments that as they were marching by, someone said that he had drafted the dead and skeletons and people that had been hanged because there is no more pathetic people that could be found.
And he also reveals that his plan is basically, in an aside, his plan is to get them all killed so he can get their pay as well.
Right.
Falstaff is not a good person.
Although this entire idea of commanding people to the front and then just letting them die, it was apparently a well enough known practice that he doesn't have to say it outright.
Prince comes up and talks to him and is like very glad to see him on the field of battle.
Yeah, but he says, "I did never see such pitiful rascals," to which Falstaff says, "Good enough to toss. Food for powder, food for powder. They'll fit a pit as well as better. Mortal men.
Mm-hmm.
He always has good dialogue, but yeah. He rarely does anything good. When they point out that the soldiers are too beggarly, he says, "I don't know where they got that idea of being poor from." And I don't know where they got their idea of not having any clothes. They never learned it from me. So in scene 2, we're back with the rebels. They are essentially resolved to attack as soon as possible.
The only advantage they have right now is that they're rested and the king's troops are not.
They have worse supplies than the king's stuff, because the king has an entire kingdom and they're just a rebel army, so they have... Every day they wait, they're essentially losing advantage.
Mm-hmm. And before they can get their attack ready, Sir Walter Blunt comes over to parley.
Yeah, he's a messenger of the king, and he essentially says, "I'd like to know what your problem is with the king so we can resolve this peacefully." And they give an enormous speech about how we were promised to be the king's, you know, favored people because we helped him right in the early bit of his revolution. But you've treated us like nothing.
This is all Hotspur's speech. He's just getting angrier and angrier as he goes on. And Blunt says, "So is this what you want me to tell him?" And then Hotspur comes in and is like, no, let us talk about this a bit and we'll send a messenger over.
And then we have a bizarre scene in scene 4. I almost have a feeling this is just trying to buy some time for people to change some costumes or something.
This is, we're in York in a room in the Archbishop's palace. The Archbishop is a supporter of the rebellion.
Yeah, and essentially all that happens in this scene is the Archbishop of York gives a letter to Sir Michael saying, "Please deliver this to the rebels. I don't think they're going to win because they don't have enough troops and the enemy has more troops." And that's all that happens. I have a feeling this scene is just to buy some time.
It's also possibly there just for historical accuracy, like Shakespeare cares about that.
Yeah, I don't think he's very interested in that. Something that we've mentioned earlier is in this play, Hotspur and Hal are essentially set as point and counterpoint. They're the two possible next kings, and they're always talking about each other. But in fact, Hotspur in real life was older than King Henry IV, obviously more than 20 years older than Prince Hal. So they're really not very similar at all.
But the dynamic works much better if they're of similar age.
Right, with them as alternate characters, it's really a powerful play. As him as just older men trying to take over the kingdom, it's much weaker. So I think Shakespeare made the right call.
Yeah.
It's just not historically accurate.
Anyways, on to Act 5.
Yeah, this is the big war.
Yep. So we start off over at the king's camp.
They point out that the weather is poor and King Henry has a good line. "Then with the losers let it sympathize. Nothing can seem foul to those that win."
Worcester gives a long speech about nothing.
Well, they're all meeting with Worcester, who is the representative of the rebels.
Yes, he's here to say, "We don't like you. Here's why we're rebelling."
The rebels know that they've gone too far. They can't win back peace without victory. Hal essentially says, "I would like to have a duel with Hotspur for the entire war. Mm-hmm. He and I fight, and that decides the entire battle."
Yeah.
And in addition to that, King Henry says, "I am willing to pardon you all right now.
You just go back home, I'll pardon you all, we can pretend this never happened."
Yeah, no conditions, just stop this war, and I'm willing to stop it.
Mm-hmm. And then Falstaff wanders in.
Yeah, Falstaff interrupts the proceedings to make fun of people.
Mm-hmm.
It's really quite bold.
And nonsensical.
Well, it's actually pretty clever.
After the proceedings, he's talking to Hal and says, "Hal, if thou see me down in the battle and bestride me, so 'tis a point of friendship."
And Hal says, "Nothing but a colossus can do thee that." That is to say, bestride you, mm-hmm. get their legs around you.
And then Falstaff gives a really good speech about honor.
When Henry says, "You owest God a death."
Basically meaning, eventually everyone dies. He leaves, and then Falstaff has a nice monologue. "'Tis not due yet. I would be loth to pay him before his day. What need I be so forward with him that calls not on me? Well, 'tis no matter, honor pricks me on. Yea, but how if honor prick me off when I come on? How then? Can honor set to a leg? No. Or an arm? No. Or take away the grief of a wound? No. Honor hath no skill in surgery, then? No. What is honor? A word. What is that word honor? Air. A trim reckoning. Who hath it? He that died on Wednesday. Doth he feel it? No. Doth he hear it? No. Is it insensible, then? Yea, to the dead. But will it not live with the living? No. Why? Detraction will not suffer it. Therefore, I'll none of it. Honor is a mere scutcheon, and so ends my catechism."
He's essentially saying, "I'm not going to fight for honor, because if I die, I won't have any benefit from it, because I'll be dead. And if I win honor on the field and live, the day-to-day proceedings of life will etch away that honor. And a scutcheon is something that is carried during a funeral." So he's saying, honor is merely something that people show off at a person's corpse.
Yeah. This is one of the really good Falstaff speeches.
It's a very powerful speech. It's been the favorite of several historical figures.
And then we jump to scene two and the rebel camp.
The rebels resolve to not tell Hotspur about the king's offer of complete amnesty.
They don't necessarily think he'll take it, but they know that if he did take it, over time the king would just slowly crush them out, knowing that they were rebellious.
Even if the king didn't want to completely just take them in and then ruin them, they know they would be in too much suspicion. They've gone too far. The rebel soldiers cannot go back into English society just as reformed people. They know better than that.
Hotspur and Douglas ride up and say, okay, let's get ready for battle.
And the letter that York wrote arrives at this time, and Hotspur says, I don't have time to read that now. We've got to go to war. Although, personally, I think that even if he got the letter, he wouldn't have changed his mind.
Yeah.
I think this is supposed to be kind of a tragic thing, like, oh, he was so close to getting the information. But he's been knowing for some time that things are getting worse and worse, and he refuses to change his mind.
Mm-hmm.
And he has a great speech on refusing the after refusing the letter. Gentlemen, the time of life is short. To spend that shortness basely were too long if life did ride upon a dial's point. That's saying, if you spend your life poorly, life is too long, even if it's only an hour. And if we live to tread on kings. If we die, brave death when princes die with us. Very passionate. And he actually says, right after that, he actually says, you should think of something that would inspire you to war, because I'm not very good with words. Even though he just had a very good speech.
Yeah. It just makes you like Hotspur even more, in my opinion.
I can only imagine a perfect performance of this, how good that would be.
And then the trumpets sound. And scene three, the plain between the camps. Various battle happens on the field.
Right, so this entire scene is just a back and forth of people fighting.
Mm-hmm.
Essentially what we're doing is entering the stage from one side, having a fight. They get off the stage.
A new fight happens.
And then someone comes in from a different door and fights in a different part of the stage. So it's all one big scene, but we know that these are different parts of the battle.
Mm-hmm. And so, starting off, Douglas and someone who appears to be the king come on.
Yeah, it's actually Sir Walter Blunt, but Shakespeare made up this detail, which isn't historically accurate, that the king dressed up a bunch of people like the king, so that, I guess, he wouldn't be killed as quickly.
Yeah.
Because he's got all these imposters.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's something a lot of people do using body doubles, but it's not necessarily shown anywhere that he did that.
Yeah, he just made this up. He's not Saddam Hussein.
And so chat a little bit before they fight, and then Douglas kills Blunt. And Hotspur rises up and is like, oh, you killed the king? And the Hotspur's like, nope, not the king, sorry. Oh, there is a really good line. The king hath many marching in his coats. And Douglas says, now by my sword I will kill all his coats. I'll murder all his wardrobe piece by piece.
Until I meet the king.
Yeah.
So, just really good fighting-type speeches, really good machismo-type speeches.
And then Falstaff wanders in, and he sees the dead guy, and says, there's honor for you.
Exactly. This is what he's been saying for a while, that honor doesn't get you anything except dead. Saying that he's as hot as molten lead, and is heavy too. God keep lead out of me, that is to say, don't let me be shot.
All of his gods are dead, basically.
He mentions that only 3 of his 150 are alive. So,
yeah.
And some people like to show this as a thing that he was courageous, because he led these people into where the fighting was hot. And historically, the people watching the play would have known that, in fact, he ordered them to where it was hot, and then he would have gone into the back lines for, quote, supplies, or something like that.
Yeah.
It's very easy for a commander to send the men to die, and then just not pay them, and thereby make more money.
Mm-hmm. Then Hal walks in and asks to borrow Falstaff's sword. And Falstaff basically cages it away again and again.
Falstaff says, if the Hotspur is still alive, then I will not give anyone my sword, because he's so afraid of Hotspur that he doesn't want to be without protection. But he says, you can take my pistol.
And then the prince takes it and is like, wait, no, this is just wine again.
Yeah, Falstaff says that there's that we'll sack a city, mm-hmm. So it's a pun on sack.
Yeah, and then Falstaff
says, if Percy be alive, I'll purse him. That pierce him.
Yeah.
It works better when you pronounce it like Shakespeare would have.
Yep, and we're on to scene 4.
Yeah.
Another part of the field.
Here is the real battle stuff.
King is there, and he sees that Hal has been wounded.
Yeah, so here we've got Prince John, Prince Henry, and King Henry all on the scene.
Mm-hmm.
And he wants Henry to go back, because he's been wounded.
And Hal is like, no, 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 I gotta stay in this. You can't put me out, Coach. You can't put me out.
Yeah, he's only got a shallow scratch, which is historically accurate. Hollinshead histories do say that Hal has got a shot by an arrow in the face.
So they're hanging out for a little bit, and then Douglas runs up.
Yeah, after Prince John leaves, Douglas comes in and personally attacks the king.
Another king. They grow like Hydra's heads. I am for the Douglas, fatal to all those that wear those colors on them. And then the king says, no, I'm the real king, don't worry.
So they actually fight, and the king is going to lose when the Prince of Wales enters.
Hal just jumps in from off screen and scares off Douglas by being better than him.
Yeah, they fight until Douglas just runs away, so apparently Hal is good at fighting.
And then the king is like, thou hast redeemed thy lost opinion.
Yeah, pointing out that you've both saved the king and, you know, proved your courage and bravery.
And you could have just sat back and become king if you wanted to.
Yeah, Hal really creepily says that this would save me some time instead of poisoning you. I could have just let Douglas kill you.
Mm-hmm.
And then we get the real climax we've been waiting for all this time. Hotspur enters.
Hotspur versus Hal. We can read this one out pretty. It's pretty short, actually. If I mistake not, thou art Harry Monmouth.
Thou speak'st as though I would deny the name.
My name is Harry Percy.
Why, then I see a very valiant rebel of the name. I am the Prince of Wales, and think not, Percy, to share with me in glory any more. Two stars can keep not their motion in one sphere, nor can one England brook a double reign of Harry Percy and the Prince of Wales.
Nor shall it, Harry, for the hour is come to end the one of us. And would to God thy name and arms were now as great as mine.
I'll make it greater ere I part from thee, and all the budding honors of thy crest I'll crop to make a garland for my head.
I can no longer brook thy vanities.
And then they start to fight, and of course Falstaff comes in and just starts being a silly guy again.
Basically, the thing previously was Harry is Hal is saying, I am going to kill you and get everything and become more glorious for it.
Yeah, Hotspur says, I wish you were better at fighting, so this would be a better victory for me.
Mm-hmm.
And this is possibly the first time someone basically says, there's not enough space in England for the two of us Harrys.
Yeah, and then Falstaff comes in, comments, and then Douglas runs in, scares Falstaff, and falls down and pretends to be dead.
When Falstaff is just cheerleading Hal, Douglas fights with Falstaff, presumably very briefly,
yeah,
before Falstaff plays possum.
Hotspur is wounded by Hal.
Yeah, it says the prince killeth Percy, but presumably Percy lives a little bit more because he's still able to talk.
Oh, Harry, thou hast robbed me of my youth. And
he says that he actually regrets losing his titles and honors than losing his life. He can easily take the loss of his life, but
the fact that someone actually beat him is what's really driving him down.
Losing his glory is what really pains him. And Prince Henry really mans up here and gives a very good memorial to Hotspur, saying, when that this body did contain a spirit, a kingdom for it was too small a bound. But now two paces of the vilest earth is room enough. This earth that bears thee dead, but bears not alive so stout a gentleman. Saying, you had such a great and noble and ambitious spirit that this kingdom wasn't large enough for you when you were alive.
And now you're dead. And you can bury it in the ground, and your body is nothing.
This entire world doesn't have a single person on it as great as you that will be buried in it.
And then he sees Falstaff apparently dead.
And he says, could not all this flesh keep in a little life? So making fun of how fat he is again.
Yep. Poor Falstaff. So fat.
I should have a heavy miss of thee if I were much in love with vanity, saying that if I was still a bad person, I would feel bad about losing you. But there are worse people to lose than you.
Mm-hmm.
He just loses his friend and a person that he's never met but is glorious, and he gives a far better speech about Henry than about Falstaff.
Yep. He leaves and Falstaff gets up.
And says, oh, that's outrageous. He says, the better part of valor is discretion.
Yes.
So we've got two phrases coined in this play.
And then he sees Percy is supposedly dead, but he's like, I was just faking it. Maybe he is too. And he stabs the body.
And then that gives him the idea of saying, well, why don't I just say I kill him?
Yeah.
Like, he can take credit for this.
Henry and his brother come in.
John says, didn't you just say that Falstaff was dead?
I did. I saw him dead, breath and bleeding upon the ground.
And Falstaff says, oh, I'm quite alive. In fact, I was simply tired, and I, you know, passed out, essentially.
And then, and here's Percy, a.k.a. Hotspur. And he throws the body down.
And says, if you will do me any honor, I expect to be named Earl or Duke, at least. And Henry says, I killed Hotspur.
Didst thou? Lord, Lord, how this world is given to lying.
He looks Hal in the eyes and says, you are a liar.
And then he says they both got up at the same time and fought a long hour by Shrewsbury clock.
So somehow in maybe the 1 minute between Hotspur leaving and coming back, he managed to fight for an entire hour with someone.
I gave him this wound in the thigh. If the man were alive and would deny it, zwounds, I would make him eat a piece of my sword. Hal's just like, whatever, we don't have time for this now.
Yeah, Hal actually says, if a lie may do thee grace, I'll gild it with the happiest terms I have, saying, I know you're lying, but if this helps you out, I don't mind. Even though everything that Hal was saying up to now was saying, I will win my honor through defeating Hotspur. He's willing to just give this to Falstaff because he's such a nice guy.
Yeah, and then we're on to scene 5, another part of the field.
Yeah, it's revealed that they've won the war. The rebels are retreating.
So everyone who's still alive shows up.
And Henry, King Henry, that is, very bizarrely starts this scene by saying, thus ever did rebellion find rebuke, apparently forgetting about his own rebellion only 2 years ago, which was not rebuked in the same way.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's the thing a king is supposed to say.
Yeah, suddenly he's completely invincible.
And he's talking to Worcester, saying, how could you not relay my message to Hotspur, saying I would give him amnesty? And then he says, he'll have him executed for that.
Yeah, but he does pardon the Douglas.
Yep. The noble Scot, Lord Douglas. And the prince is actually holding him in his personal tent.
They resolve to go and defeat the other rebels, who presumably will be pretty easy to beat now that they've lost their main army. So that's the end of the play.
Yep.
It's a long one. So there's some argument as to whether this one kind of seamlessly goes into part two or not, like whether they were meant to be played in the same day.
Yeah.
But we're going to cover that in the part two episode.
Because otherwise this would be the longest podcast we ever do.
Yeah, so
except for Henry VI, part 1, 2, and 3 all together.
So we're going to look at the themes of this play really quick. One of the things that really comes up a lot is what honor is and what manliness is. Like, that's what Hal's story is all about. He's trying to prove his honor. Hotspur has already proven his honor. And
the king is worried about his own honor.
And how he's won the kingship and all this stuff. And there's this entire mirror of Macbeth where Hotspur wants to take over the kingship. And Henry IV is concerned about usurpation because he usurped the throne, just like Macbeth was concerned the same way.
And there's also the issues of how much of honor translates after death and stuff like that. Like with Falstaff talking about that.
His transcendent speech on honor.
And then even Hal comments on that after Hotspur dies that he is nothing now, basically.
Yeah. People have really loved this throughout history.
That's because it is pretty awesome.
The book I read pointed out that in one generation there were 3 famous people to play Falstaff. Within 20 years, 3 famous portrayers of Falstaff. He's one of the most powerful characters Shakespeare's written, and certainly one of the most beloved.
Mm-hmm.
But we're not going to talk about him because he's going to have his own episode.
Yep.
It was played almost continuously until the mid-1800s, and then the play has kind of fallen off since then, and it's pretty rare to see it performed today.
I actually did see a performance of it in England, though.
Right. It's not a Timon of Athens or a Troilus and Cressida, where no one's ever heard of it.
Or a Winter's Tale, where they refuse to play it.
Yeah, where it's just impossible to put on.
Yeah.
But it's just not as popular today as it was before, where it was immensely popular.
Which is too bad, because it is a really good play.
Yeah, it's got a lot of good speeches.
Mm-hmm.
In research for this, we saw 2 different movies. This film that we saw, which is just a straight interpretation of the play, titled simply Henry IV Part 1, I think we both liked that performance. I'm going to have a link to it on the blog.
Okay.
Bardcast.blogspot.com. If you want to check it out, it's at Netflix, or if you want to buy it, you can go to Amazon through our website.
So anyways, we saw this film version of it, which was really good. It had a great Hotspur and a great Falstaff, and Hal was pretty good as well.
Yeah, the king wasn't very interesting, but he's not a very interesting character in the play. Even though the play is named after him, he's not the main character. You could say that this is the play of stage stealing, because Henry IV has the stage stolen by Henry V. Henry V has the scene stolen by Falstaff. And Hotspur sort of steals the entire plot from everyone else.
He's just so manly.
Yeah, he's so dynamic and so powerful that he really steals the feel of the play.
Aside from that, we saw
the film Chimes at Midnight, the Orson Welles, which he essentially designed so that he could play Falstaff.
Yeah, and it's basically, it combines parts from Henry IV, part 1 and 2, Henry V, and the Merry Wives of Windsor all into one.
Although not very much of the Merry Wives of Windsor.
Or Henry V.
It's essentially Orson Welles decided that he would like to play Falstaff, so he put on this movie. It's pretty good.
It has one really famous scene in it, too.
Yes, the battle scene in Chimes at Midnight is one of the more influential things in film history. If you've seen Braveheart, or really any battle scene in modern media, it is certainly influenced by Chimes at Midnight. I mean, Braveheart looks like plagiarism when you watch Chimes at Midnight. Braveheart is obviously more sophisticated.
You can't really plagiarize a battle scene with... I mean, it's not like they're ripping moves.
I'm not actually accusing them of a crime.
Okay.
It's what has made modern war movies what they are.
And then I also saw the version I saw in England, which was back-to-back performance. One day Henry IV Part 1, one day Henry IV Part 2.
Okay.
Yeah, same actors.
So did they do anything interesting with the setting or scene?
Same actors for everything.
I mean, did they set it in the future?
No, it was set in proper time.
That seems to be more common for the histories. They tend
set them in proper time? Gee, I wonder why.
They're more rooted in the scene and time.
And it was very epic on scale. Like, they didn't have a huge battle scene, but there were at least 30 people on stage for that, I'd say.
Okay, that's pretty good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then they had, like, actual sets and stuff down there, not just scene, like, backdrops and stuff.
Right.
And it was in, like, a big theater, not, like, the Globe or anything.
So a pretty professional production.
Yeah.
Good.
Also, I mean, parts of it were pretty... Well, Henry IV Part 2 is kind of dull in its own right, but... They didn't go out of their way to make it more interesting.
Okay.
Except for Hotspur. Hotspur is always my favorite.
Right. So this play has been interpreted in a lot of different ways. A lot of this has to do with Falstaff, but we're going to skip him again. The thing that we're going to talk about the interpretation of is Prince Hal.
Yes.
Because most interpretations of his character have him as the happy companion of Falstaff.
They view his reformation as genuine, him changing his feelings.
At the end of King Henry IV Part 2, Hal essentially turns around and becomes the good king that everyone thinks that he should have been the entire time.
Mm-hmm.
Like we said, he has that speech where he essentially says he's going to do that. That makes us think that he's doing this all on purpose.
Yeah. He's doing it on purpose. He thinks, well, I could spend this time being stuffy like my brother, or I could go out and have fun and then reform, and everyone will love me even more for having reformed.
I think people take his genuine enjoyment of his life of sin as this kind of proof that he doesn't have a long-term plan. And I kind of think of Oscar Schindler from Schindler's List.
I think this is a horrible metaphor.
Let me explain. Oscar Schindler had an ulterior motive. He wanted to save people's lives. But he also enjoyed himself when he was hobnobbing it with the German elite. He enjoyed his social life while simultaneously having a separate plan, which he was not revealing to anyone.
I guess.
I'm just comparing it to something that people can think of when they're considering the issue.
Okay. But either way, a lot of critics dismiss this argument.
Right. Most people seem to think that Hal is just this innocent, and I think they kind of think that his transformation at the end of Part 2 is just out of character.
Mm-hmm. But no, it's been... Now, aside from the fact that he's been planning it all along, they also build up to it quite a bit.
Right. When he says that he will banish John Falstaff, he will banish the world. I mean, that's pretty clear.
Yes.
So we're going to talk about how much we like the play. I think we have already basically made this clear that we do like the play a lot.
I say this about a lot of Shakespeare plays, but I would put it in my top 10 Shakespeare
plays.
We'll
have to do a list sometime of our top 10.
Maybe near the end.
Maybe an episode about it.
Yes. Well, we could do an episode about our top 10 of everything, really.
Sure, yeah, that would be fun, actually.
I mean, like, I would put Hotspur in my top 10 characters, top 10 Shakespeare characters.
Right, we could do top 10 villains, stuff like that.
Hotspur heads all my lists, really.
Top 10 women.
Lady Hotspur.
So we both agree that it's a good play, so we'll just move on. There is a little bit of news I'd like to talk about. Bill Bryson, whose Shakespeare book I've been endorsing since the very beginning of this podcast, has come out with a new version of the same book. I think it's just a Christmas deal where that you try to get the book out before Christmas, and it's the same book but with more content. I haven't had a chance to take a look at it, so I can't really give a review of it. It's got a bunch of pictures in it, is the main thing that I've heard.
I haven't seen it.
Yeah, we'll give it a review once we actually get our hands on it.
Let's see. Any news?
Well, there is some news about the podcast itself. This is our 15th episode, and it's sort of our anniversary. I think we should celebrate a little bit.
Okay, yeah, we'll celebrate by doing absolutely nothing.
So hooray.
Yay.
I did a little math, and I estimate that we'll have about 75 episodes in sum. So this puts us 1/5 of the way through our episodes that we'll do. So thank you, everyone, for listening, and I've been enjoying this process.
I've enjoyed it a bit, too, yeah.
In other news, one of our listeners has been incredibly kind and given us a nomination for a Best Podcast contest.
That's the 2009 Web Blog Awards.
Yeah, we'll link to it on the blog, bardcast.blogspot.com. Mm-hmm. And I think the voting is over. We'll have to check
that. The nomination period is over. They will be deciding the finalists over the next month. And the voting on those finalists will begin January 4th.
So if you listen and you enjoy it, please vote for us, obviously.
Yep. I mean, we don't think we're going to win or anything. No, we don't have a chance of that, but it's always good to get publicity.
I can't say how much I appreciate this from you guys. Another thing that you can do if you'd like to help us out is go to iTunes and give us a review on the feed page. Something actually funny happened with this. Somebody went on there and gave us a 1-star review because we were so stupid. We wrote Richard II when we actually meant Richard III. Apparently the person who reviewed our podcast decided that when we made an episode about Richard II, we just didn't realize that there was only Richard III, when in fact this fool didn't know there was a play called Richard II, and we just haven't gotten to Richard III.
Yes, it's quite hilarious.
So we'd appreciate it if you guys would go there and give more informed reviews. This has been Bardcast. Our next episode is going to be about Shakespeare as a fictional character. Think Shakespeare in Love. Just Shakespeare as he appears as a character in other media.
Mm-hmm. This could be a long or short podcast, depending on how much we can find.
Yeah. I think it'll be a fun one, though.
Yep.
So thanks for listening, and I'm Carson.
And I'm Jeff.
And goodbye.
Ah. So me cracking open this soda? Rose? I disagree with this decision, but we're not going to include my disagreement in the podcast. We should do a Hotspur podcast. I could talk about it forever.